Hey, Steve Smith.
Hello, Brett Starr.
How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm great. It's a beautiful day in Fort Worth, Texas. It's cooling off. It's been raining, and fall is on the way, so I'm feeling pretty good. How are things in St. Louis?
Today's a little humid and rainy, but it's going to be a perfect fall weekend. Very cool, and looking forward to that.
Awesome. Well, thanks for jumping back on again this week to talk about Work Tech Weekly. That will be going out on Friday. You circulate a version of it internally, usually 2 or 3 days before it goes out on the wire. Mm-hmm. And it always, you know, like I said, the last week when we got together, it's where I get all my news. I just think that it was, you know, chock full of so many interesting things. What's in the issue this week? What are you going to be talking about?
You know, I mean, there's so much stuff going on. I mean, the biggest challenge that we have is the fact that there's so much earth-shattering news that seems to be happening every day. I think that right up there at the top is certainly the Microsoft acquisition of Ally for OKRs to fold into the Microsoft Viva employee experience platform. Certainly been getting a lot of questions about that throughout the week.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I've been getting a lot of, you know, I'm sure this has happened to you as well, but I get a question about Microsoft Viva like every day.
Yeah.
And, you know, when it comes to, you know, Microsoft, I think there is a wide range of emotions, you know, out there, from like abject fear and terror to like, you know, a very opportunity, you know, rooted perspective on what this means for the marketplace. And, you know, but before I definitely want to, you know, double click on Microsoft Viva and talk about that, because I just think there's so much to explore that is even beyond the context of this most recent acquisition. Because it's funny, you know, Microsoft Viva goes out and, you know, they make an acquisition in the OKR or, you know, performance management, continuous performance management, feedback and goals, whatever you want to call it. And that segment, you know, gets crazy. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, it's happened in multiple segments as they've announced different partners in learning and different partners in well-being. It's like, what does this mean for us? And is this bad or good or whatever? So I just, there's so many things that I want to talk about there. But I thought it was kind of funny because, you know, last week, like I just said, you always send out an internal version of this. Mm-hmm. And between the time that you sent out that internal version and then we talked the next day to record the podcast, by the time, you know, it was ready to go out Friday, like three other huge things had happened that were, So did you actually, last week you said, well, look, it goes out on Friday and, you know, it went out. Did you go back and add in, you know, some of that stuff that happened, or did it get bumped to this Friday?
No, I mean, I had to go back and add in stuff. And I mean, it was stuff like, you know, I do some of the pre-work, the week before, do a little work on Sunday, but it's just like, even like I was within an hour of going to send out this week, that big Personio deal was announced, the German HCM company.
Yeah.
And it's like, gosh, it is so hard just to kind of keep up with the goings on in the news. Although, kind of back to your point on the Viva acquisition that I thought was really funny, is people will text me or email me all the time when they see kind of news items. They say, hey, kind of what about this? But what's really kind of an interesting indicator is I got a few emails that were like just a question in an email and were obviously sent in such haste that they didn't bother to put in a subject line. And the fact that people who ordinarily, like, you know, complete thoughts and very kind of formal email etiquette are just kind of dashing out these questions, I thought was very indicative of how people kind of feel about this acquisition and just kind of how Viva really is top of mind in the market right now.
Well, there's so much fun stuff to talk about on that. I do have to, you know, reference one other point in that, you know, in the last conversation that we had and something you just said. You know, you mentioned that, you know, the company in Europe that, you know, basically is not only like one of the largest work tech companies now, right? Or most valuable work tech companies in Europe, but actually one of the largest and most valuable companies, period.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the way things are now. Like, work tech is like the, you know, the big fish.
Yeah.
And so it's not, so it wasn't surprising to me. I think it's cool and interesting to talk about, but it wasn't surprising to me at all. I mean, I think of like Ireland, for instance, and you've got Workhuman in Ireland, and they're a unicorn. And so, you know, I think that's probably one of the highest valued, you know, businesses in Ireland. And so, and you see that in the U.S. as well. And it's just, you know, we've been doing this for a long time. It's just crazy to see work tech at the, you know, top of the food chain.
Well, and it's interesting also, there's just so many really innovative and interesting work tech companies coming out of France right now.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, it's sort of like PeopleDoc was the one that sort of blazed the trail. And now it's just like you've got, you know, PayFit and like last week Swile, and just there's like a dozen like just, you know, explosive growth, really interesting companies that are coming out of that ecosystem.
You know, it's really interesting. I love Swile. I love the idea behind Swile. Most people won't get Swile, and you, yeah. you mentioned that. But we did a lot of work with Sodexo back in the day. And, you know, we know that, you know, the benefits market and, you know, all around the world, you know, like in Brazil, for instance, you know, employers are required to provide one meal a day to mm-hmm. employees. And most of that's done on stored value cards or whatever. And so one of the things that Sodexo was extremely successful at in a short period of time, like, a decade, mm-hmm. was basically getting every restaurant around the world. You know, you would walk up and see the Michelin stars or the, you know, the Zagat or the, you know, like what the decals that are usually yeah. on, you know, a restaurant door. And if you were in Europe or in South America or something, you'd also see a Sodexo, you know, sticker on the door. And that meant that you could use your Sodexo card in there. And so, you know, that's a long tradition. And, you know, there's some very disruptive things going on there. But it also reminds me of our multiple. How many times have we been to Europe together? Oh, my God.
A dozen.
I can't remember half the trips,
but
you know, we were going to France and saw a lot of stuff happening in France mm-hmm. A long time ago. And, you know, it's not surprising to me at the same time that, you know, it's cool mm-hmm. To see so much innovation coming out of France. But, you know, our roots in France go all the way back to Mr. Ted and
Jerome.
Yeah, who's now, you know, running Smart Recruiters. And, you know, I just think that, you know, when you really start, you know, double-clicking on all these, you know, different areas of innovation around the world, there's just so many pockets that, you know, most people aren't aware of. And so it seems like they come out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
But even, you know, 7 or 8 years ago when we were going to Europe, there were a lot of companies coming out of, you know, France and stuff like that. That were at the beginning of that wave of innovation.
Well, what I think is really interesting also about specifically kind of European work tech companies that are, you know, as they begin to kind of blow up on the global stage and they have to, you know, they've, you know, been big in Europe and they have to break into the North America market, there's such a chasm that they have to jump over just in terms of their marketing style, because everything is so much more kind of like PR focused and indirect in Europe. And they really, you know, and American companies get it the opposite. They try to take an American style to Europe and it just like running into a brick wall because they hate the hard charging, hey, buy my stuff kind of approach. And it's just the opposite. It's so, you know, these European companies, they always struggle for usually 18 to 24 months because they're trying to run that indirect, oh, I'm not going to ask for a sales conversation approach. Yeah. And their numbers are just horrible. And then they're like, hey, what do we have to do? It's just like, well, you got to put on the cowboy hat and get the big foam number one finger and you got to go out and sell some shit. And eventually they figure that out.
That brings back so many good memories of, you know, it's like times that we went to Europe and, you know, we would hang out with the person who had been sent there to develop, you know, some, you know, part of Europe.
Yeah.
And that was the model, you know, 10 years ago or, you know, even 20 years ago. And, you know, it's we've been all around the world. We've been all over the country and there are different cultures, even from like state to state in terms of like, you know, the executive culture and the marketing culture and, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's also, you know, the thing that I'll always remember is on one of our trips to London, I think it was. Yeah, it was definitely London. We had like 23 meetings in like 4 days.
Yeah.
And this was really before, you know, the UK had all of these amazing, big players that they have now. But they had, I mean, there was enough people there that we met with like over 20 companies mm-hmm. that run the work tech field. And we came away on the last day from that meeting thinking that we had probably closed like 15 deals because like every single one of those meetings was just fantastic. And, you know, there was, and then we didn't close a single deal.
Right. I know. Like, what the hell happened?
And then like 2 years later, they all started to like, you know, come into our universe.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just how long it takes, which, you know, I think it's, you know, there are definitely cultural nuances wherever you're working, but. You know, I think there's also something powerful to be said there about engagement and mm-hmm. engaging and, you know, having conversations without expecting a direct sales outcome. Because if you stick around long enough, you know, a lot of the people that you know and meet, you'll end up working with in the future. But
well, and I think that it kind of points to, you know, the customer experience model that is now so prevalent and lots of people are beginning to whiteboard and work up methodologies and blah, 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 blah. And it's just like, that was sort of, we were doing it. We just didn't know we were doing it because it's just like, you go in, let's have a conversation. I'm not trying to sell you a bunch of shit. I'm not going to roll the pin at the end of this, but let's just have a conversation, be real, give away some value.
Yeah.
And I think that the affirmation that was the right approach, it was a long tail, but like 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, people looping back and saying, hey, I remember that conversation we had, and it really struck me that you said XYZ. And so I know that that's sort of like, you know, customer experience model, you know, as kind of the front end really does work, because it's just like, that's the entire experience that ideally we want customers to have when they're engaging with our brand.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought that our ignorance was our greatest asset.
Oh yeah,
our lack of experience, not knowing how things should be done.
Oh yeah,
just doing it the way that
we're really good at that.
Yeah, and we still are in many ways. But you know, to your point, then we should get to Microsoft Viva because
that's what
everyone really wants to talk about.
Yeah, that's true.
I remember having a conversation with you know, someone who you know is a very influential member of the work tech community right now. I'm not going to say his name because he'll get mad at me. But you know, I had a conversation with him, you know, I thought it was great. And, you know, we always enter conversations or we do these like 3-4 hour meetings with people and just give away value and we have fun doing it and we learn things. I remember walking away from that conversation thinking, well, you know, that guy wasn't like super engaged, but I sure liked him a lot. And then like 2 years later, he comes back and he has this napkin that was sitting on the board, on the table, where we were meeting, and he had written down like 3 of our models. And he said that he had like kept that on his desk for like the last 2 years and was just waiting for the right moment to work with us. And, you know, so I think just, you know, having that abundance mindset of, you know, trying to help people and going into it, not, you know, acting like you know everything, but, you know, that you also want to learn has served us very well over the years. And,
So yeah, we learn a lot more in those conversations as anything. You know, it's just like you have to go in and just, you know, hey, what can I get out of this in terms of reframing the way that I think?
Well, and it's one of the biggest problems in B2B is that everyone is super focused on purchase intent and they want to aim all of their resources at somebody who wants to buy something. And if they don't think somebody has, you know, the you know, budget, authority, you know, et cetera, and has an active need and a time frame to buy something, they don't want to spend time with those folks in a traditional B2B context.
Right.
And that's where all the value is. That's where, you know, you're building, you know, that engagement and all that stuff. And so I think the world's coming around to that and understanding that. And so, you know, I'm definitely seeing a lot of, you know, kind of more conversations happening instead of like, you know, agendas. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's a good thing. So Microsoft Viva. Let's talk about Microsoft Viva.
Viva la Viva.
What the hell is going on with Microsoft Viva? That's a terrible lead-in.
Yeah, it's a terrible lead-in. Everything. I mean, they've kind of really quickly become the 18,000-pound gorilla in employee experience, you know, and it's just like employee experience being this thing that is so large that it's mm-hmm. it's almost meaningless. They really have kind of provided some gravity around the center of that galaxy.
Oh. So I've got to, I can't not say this. When was the first time that you remember us identifying the fact that there was going to be an integrated employee experience platform market and mapping what the categories were that were, you know, going to be moving in that direction? And
2012.
And I think maybe in 2012, we were talking about it more in terms of engagement. And yeah. then, you know, at some point we changed our language a little bit to experience. And, so here we are now. And I think it's also worth pointing out that we talk a lot about market development. Mm-hmm. And, you know, markets start with a lot of component-based solutions. Those components grow into category-based solutions. Eventually, the categories start, you know, blending with adjacent categories and mm-hmm. pursuing that kind of platform position. And then the really big companies come, knocking and buy their way into the innovation that they missed over the last 10 years.
Right.
Like going all the way back to like the integrated talent management motion. And so we kind of saw all of that, you know, coming to pass. And when the Microsoft Viva announcement, I just thought was fantastic.
Yeah.
Because it basically marked the beginning of the migration from the category stage of the market to the platform stage of the market.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we've seen this all before. I mean, anybody who wants to know what impact this is going to have or what it means, the employee experience platform market was firmly established as, you know, a real thing when Microsoft Viva came out. Now we've probably got about, 5 to 7 years of, you know, people vying for leadership at the employee experience level before, you know, the really big companies come in and, you know, buy them, like, you know, SAP bought SuccessFactors and right. like Oracle bought Taleo and, you know, on and on and on. So, we kind of knew this moment was coming. I didn't think it would be Microsoft that, you know, kind of made the category. Did you?
No, I mean, it didn't seem like it was headed that direction, but, you know, they sort of took an outside-in approach because they built everything else. Mm-hmm. You know, they had Office, they had Outlook, then, you know, Teams became the fastest-growing product in the history of Microsoft, and that was even before March of 2020, and then after that, it was just turbocharged the growth. But, you know, they had that. They had the Skype acquisition. They had LinkedIn. You know, they bought Glint. I mean, they've been like that. They bought Lynda.com. They've been building and building and building. And it's funny because when you go and you do a briefing with somebody from Microsoft, you see these very grandiose plans. You're like, wow, that is really fucking cool. But it's going to take you forever to get there. And it's just everything mm-hmm. moves at a very glacial pace. But it's just kind of now getting to the point where the momentum is finally there. And it's just like the vision is truly becoming reality.
Well, and timing's everything, right? So
yeah.
like, you know, after years of making acquisitions, everyone was like, is Microsoft getting into the work tech space? Like, this has been going on for like the last, you know, 10 years. Is
yeah.
Microsoft getting into the work tech space? Only we didn't call it work tech 10
right.
years ago.
No.
But it's like they already are, you know, and everyone, I think, had this perception that they were buying all these, you know, companies in a very like, non-strategic way mm-hmm. and weren't, integrating them to their, you know, kind of maximum benefit. But timing's everything. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, they had everything ready to go when the pandemic hit and it became, you know, obvious that we were in the middle of a new organizing principle where the focus was going to be on employee experience mm-hmm. More than kind of this command and control, driven paradigm of, you know, the old school performance management, the old school talent acquisition, the old school learning and development, everything. They had all the pieces in place. And what they, I think, have that people underestimated, and I know this is one of your favorite topics, too, is they're the largest productivity platform on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
And so everything's about the flow of work now. And as you know, this new organizing principle is taking shape in the market, which I believe is about, you know, people are coming up with dumb things, you know, like
they don't stop.
I saw somebody post yesterday that's like, would you please stop writing articles about the Great Resignation?
Yeah.
And I was like, I totally agree with that. That is not the organizing principle. That is like a watered down war for talent type message that doesn't really touch.
It's a scarcity mindset.
Yeah, it is a scarcity mindset. It doesn't touch the significant society-wide shift that we're going through. And so I think the organizing principle is more about decentralization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think people are moving in every aspect of their life to, more. It's probably semi-decentralized organizations, semi-autonomous organizations. We're not talking about crypto companies that are DAOs and all that stuff. We're talking about normal companies who are becoming more decentralized, more autonomous, but it's happening at every level. And what Microsoft has is they sew everything together because they can just put it right on, you know, all of those, you know, productivity platforms that you just talked about.
Right.
So.
But I think what's also interesting is I agree with you around decentralization, but what I'm kind of curious to see and what I've been getting a lot of questions about is, okay, so Microsoft acquires an OKR platform. What does that do for all of these other OKR platforms that have raised, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars apiece? You know, there's a lot of investment, and that may be the reddest of the red ocean categories in work tech. You know, does that completely blow up that entire market? And
what do you think?
I don't think it does. I think it changes the game. I think that what you're going to see happen is that old CFO conversation of why are we buying this OKR platform because it's already in our instance of Microsoft. Why don't we just use what they have? Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, there's going to be different flavors for different organizations and different areas of need. But I also kind of feel like because of that move that you're going to see OKRs and in some way end up being commodified.
Yeah.
Is sort of my take. What about you?
I don't know. You know, it's interesting. I'm conflicted about it because, I mean, we all know that no one, you know, can have 100% market share.
Right.
So I think the first point that you brought up, I totally agree with. Which is we all need this and we all want this. People may not know that or feel that, but we need, you know, someone with the, you know, kind of gravity of Microsoft to help establish, you know, the platform, you know, the transition into the platform stage of this market development. Mm-hmm. But what we know from experience is that it's going to spin off, you know, 15 or 20 other, you know, big, power players.
Yeah.
At that level, and I think it's going to throw off, you know, multiple acquisitions, multiple partnerships, and so I see it as a good thing. You know, if anything, you know, so I have a problem with OKRs specifically.
I think OKRs are bullshit.
Well, you know, I won't go that far.
I
think that
I will take an extreme position on this.
Well, the problem that I have with OKRs is that it's one way, you know. And for some reason, you know, people are kind of very cultish about, you know, OKRs as a style of performance management. Mm-hmm. But there's multiple styles and, you know, different companies are going to have different cultures.
Right.
And they're going to prefer different types of solutions that can still be performance management and goals and feedback oriented and all that stuff that don't have anything to do with OKRs.
Right.
So, you know, I think that, you know, the notion of being able to, you know, kind of set up some cascading, you know, aligned goals is probably going to be commodified.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the primary value of a good performance management system anymore.
Well, and I guess the thing about it is just to, you know, be serious and not just intentionally inflammatory taking your dream position. I think that the problem with OKRs is it's hard, and well, it's not so much OKRs as it is goal alignment and cascading goals. Mm-hmm. I believe that business is moving too fast and has been moving. I mean, this is not just a 2020 thing. This has been true for better part of the last decade. The speed of business just it turns goal setting and goal alignment into sort of this exercise where it really becomes misaligned and non-relevant to the business. You're just kind of doing it because you think that this is what a good business is supposed to do. And you can't say, yeah. Oh no, we don't align goals, because you would sound freaking crazy if you went out as any large employer and said that. But the truth is just like, I don't know how relevant a lot of these goals are in a lot of organizations. And I think that as the basic unit of work becomes the team, I think there's some value in kind of getting team goals aligned, but I don't think that that's necessarily transacted best in sort of a goal conversation. I think it's more of a coaching and feedback conversation.
Yeah, it reminds me. So I have a problem with a label. That's, you know.
Yeah, me too.
You know, it reminds me a lot of agile. And
yeah.
So, you know, this person over here says, you know, we're agile. And then this company over here says they're not agile. They don't know anything about it. Do you have Scrum? Do you have, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then so everyone has a different view of like how agile works, right? And like how the right way to do it, and the wrong way to do it. And I think it's very similar with OKRs. I don't think that, you know, the OKR style is necessarily, works against agile goal setting, and creating more autonomy and allowing creativity and stuff like that. But some people who have like religion around OKRs believe that if you do not have the, you know, interlocking goal set that aligns from top to bottom in the organization, then you're doing it wrong. I think, unfortunately, that's just kind of an unfair characterization of, you know, what you can do with technologies like that and with systems like that. I mean, you can, you know, bend them to your culture. I think the thing that you have to be careful of, which we've seen, we've experienced as owners, and we've seen in, you know, hundreds of clients, is be careful what software you buy, because it can have a dramatic impact on your culture, because it has cultural notions built into it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think it ultimately, you know, I don't think people, I think that people in the performance management space, continuous performance management, goals and feedback, OKRs, you know, whatever flavor you want to refer to, you want to use to refer to this new way of thinking about goal setting, they should be jumping up and down with joy right now instead of afraid.
Yeah.
Because in my view, what Microsoft Viva just did was establish the fact that performance management fits into the employee experience in an integrated way with all the other stuff, you know, that they kind of led with. So I think that that's just going to, you know, open people up to, you know, this kind of natural motion that happens at this stage of market development, which is people start to value integration over the depth of functionality in any single category, and they just want all the stuff to work together. So I think it's going to open up tons of opportunities. I think that segment is going to grow tremendously.
Yeah.
What else is going on?
You know, one of the, headlines that kind of got lost in the shuffle last week that I thought was interesting was another funding event. It was the Mom Project getting $80 million.
Yeah, talk about that. I saw that. That really stood out to me as well. What's going on with the Mom Project?
You know, I mean, I think that the one of the key themes going on in the workplace today is just, you know, how difficult work is for women and working moms specifically, and how they are under just a whole different level of pressure than men in the workplace, just to be completely blunt about it. But also it's just like the, you know, and specifically kind of the way that they're approaching it is, what do you do if you are a, you know, a working mom who wants to get off of the work track for a few years, but then wants to get back on as kids go, you know, get to the point where they can go back to school, and you want to, and it's just like, it's when you get off of that kind of like career trajectory, it's hard to kind of get plugged back in. And I think that they have a really fantastic solution, and not only just a cool solution, but a very well marketed solution in terms of addressing something that is very much of the moment and kind of in tune with the zeitgeist now. So
yeah, and they have the right the type of origin story that I like to see that's associated with companies that succeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it all, the spark was, you know, it's all purpose driven. Yeah. It started at a very like community, you know, level of people helping each other out, and they've just continued to build on kind of that core purpose and, you know, execute in more sophisticated ways. And, you know, I'll also say that, you know, I've done a lot of research over the past couple of years on role theory mm-hmm. and role strain. And, you know, when things get bad, like during the pandemic and everything, they always get worse for, you know, women, and they always get worse for people of color and, you know, all kinds of, you know, different groups that, you know, are that just don't have the same, you know, opportunities or privilege that some of us just kind of walk into because mm-hmm. of, you know, the accident of our birth. And, you know, one of the primary things that we all saw happening and that we experienced was that role strain. So you have these social roles, and you know, like you identify as, I am a worker, I am a father, I am a whatever. And you have to give time to each one of these roles. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they kind of go back and forth in terms of where you need to, you know, spend your time. But the role strain that exists between, you know, someone being a mother and everything that, you know, came along with that during the pandemic, and also, you know, their role at work, that strain was, you know, way more significant than many of us experienced. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's just any solution that is focused on that is something that is badly needed, because it's, I mean, it's not like it, you know, people write about it in the papers like that happened and it's over.
Yeah.
That's not the case. I mean, it's still really, really hard. And so I was really happy to read that.
Well, and I mean, and I think sort of in a related note, just a topic that's been coming up is more and more is just like, hey, you know what? 2021 for some reason is a lot harder than 2020.
Yeah.
And it's just, I think it's just, you know, having to kind of live in this reality and just becoming aware that, oh, so we're not going to wake up one day and everything's going to be the way it was in 2019.
No. And, you know, I think it's going to take years for people to understand what we've been through and to see how things shake out. But until you have time to really reflect on it and think about what you've been through, I think and many of us, you know, just haven't had the opportunity to do that in a significant way because we've been just trying to survive and get through and, you know, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. I think the profound level of change that we've experienced and the profound level of stress that we've experienced during the last 2 years is going to appear sharper in retrospect than it does right now when we're inside the tornado.
Yeah. Well, you know, another interesting thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately is something that we talk about internally is how do you make sure that you are maintaining a strong, vibrant culture when you have a distributed hybrid workforce? And, you know, sometimes it's just like you wonder, it's just like, are we the only ones thinking about this? And this past weekend, I went to a wedding for the first time in like a year and a half. And I was talking to one of my friends here in St. Louis, who is the CEO of a large local nonprofit, has several hundred employees. And I was asking her, I was like, what is your biggest, you know, kind of work business challenge right now? And she was like, it's maintaining a strong culture with a team that I can't get in the office at the same time. And I was just really, really interested to hear her talk about it and unpack that, because I realized just how pervasive and ongoing that issue really is.
Yeah. It's a delicate thing. You know, that, you know, the way it works, the way culture works, the things that drive it, are poorly understood by most.
Yeah.
And it's easier to see the absence of it, or, you know, kind of the to see it degrading without really knowing why. But in the context that we've been in for the, you know, the past couple of years, I mean, the, you know, the reasons are pretty obvious. And, you know, I hope that what comes out of this is that when we see what impact you know, the pandemic has had on the way we work and the impact that it's had on cultures, that we start to understand how culture works better, because it, you know, has been kind of cast in sharp relief, mm-hmm. By the conditions that we've been under. So I think a lot of good's going to come out of it. But it's painful sometimes to get to the good, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, cool, man. I look forward to speaking with you next week. We're going to talk a lot between next week, but, you know, we'll be on camera next week again and talking about whatever other AD acquisitions and funding announcements and, you know, major mind-blowing blockbuster things happen between, you know, now and next week. But as always, good talking to you.
Good talking to you.
And I'm going to hit the stop button.